So the Bible has the answer. Let's start there. The Bible has five very key answers for us. Number one, who created? Now, here's our foundation. This is our actual foundation for everything in the Bible. It starts right there in Genesis. You know, the Bible tells us who created? That's easy, God, isn't it? You know, that's a theme throughout the entire Bible. Almost every book of the Bible teaches God is the creator of all things. From the book of Genesis, even through the book of Revelation, talks about God as the creator of all things. Do you know we have an answer for what was created? We actually know what was created. The Bible tells us all things. Colossians 1:16, by him all things, not some, not a few, but the word is all things created. And it says things like visible and invisible. That means the things we can see and the things we can't see. So the Bible's clear on that statement. So the New Testament teaches about creation. You know, the Bible teaches how things were created. And I run across people coming out of these seminaries saying, oh, the Bible doesn't teach how God created. Yes, it does. It says multiple times how God created. By his power. You know, the first chapter of Genesis, it teaches how he created many times. He called it into existence out of nothing. You know, in Psalms 33, 6 and 9, by the word of the Lord. Even in the New Testament, it teaches how God created. Hebrews 11, verse 3, through faith we understand the worlds were framed by the word of God. Both the Old and the New Testament teaches how God created. He simply spoke it into existence. And if we start saying you can't do that, then we're starting to create God in our own image, aren't we? God is God. He told us how he created, and we need to accept it. You know, the Bible clearly teaches when God created. It very clearly teaches when he created. In the beginning. It says that both the New Testament and the Old Testament. Right out of the Gospels, in the beginning. Book of John. But you know, the Bible tells us how long it took him to create. 6 days. Now, those are not six ages, because the word is day in the Hebrew. And the grammatical structure of the Hebrew sentence and the context of the language says 6 days. You know, many people believe this. I know there's people out there who don't believe that. But let me show you some of the people that do believe it. Astronomers, astrophysicists, Hebrew scholars. And I like the last one, God. That makes it pretty important. You know, right there in Exodus 20, verse 11, in Exodus 20, verse 11, we're in the middle of the Ten Commandments, and God is writing this down on the stone tablets himself. And you know what he writes down? For in 6 days, the Lord made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. So God believes it. That's good enough for me. All your major lexicons also say it means 6 days. So there's an awful lot of scientists out there, and most all the Hebrew scholars will say the language says 6 days. Just some people choose not to believe that. So we have a foundation. We know who created, what was created, when it was created, how it was created, and how long it took. We have a foundation. We know how all that happened. God's word tells us. So now, what is evolution? Well, this is what evolution is. First of all, we need to understand evolution is based on something called materialism. It means everything we see out there has to be explained in terms of materialistic ideas, or everything has to come into existence through naturalistic causes. In other words, evolution does not allow for a creator God. And we need to get that into most of the churches in this country, because most churches are trying to put evolution and the Bible together. Folks, you cannot put two opposites together. Evolution clearly believes there is no creator God. Folks, if there's no creator God, there's no Jesus Christ. Because who's the creator of all things? The Bible tells us, Jesus Christ. Now do you see the connection why this is important? Because evolution, folks, is a direct attack on the gospel, because it denies Jesus Christ. It is an important issue. So we need to remember, if evolution is going to be right, they have to be able to explain everything in terms of materialistic ideas or naturalistic causes. Now here's the problem. There's a lot of churches out there trying to put these two ideas together. Let me show you just a couple of reasons why you can't combine these two. You know, the evolution model says the universe exploded into existence out of nothing. We're going to talk about that one in just a moment. You know, the Bible teaches in the beginning God created. Right there, tell us, right? You cannot put these two together. Then there's another one. Life evolved from a pool of chemicals by natural processes. You know what the Bible tells us? God created all things after their kind. Those are opposites. Evolution says different life forms evolved from a common ancestor over millions of years. The Bible says everything was created after its kind. Those are just three quick examples to show you cannot put evolution in the Bible. But you know a lot of people in churches out there are doing that? You know what they're doing to get them together? Not changing evolution. They're changing God's word. How shaky of a foundation do they have in God now, when they're so willingly and easily changing God's word? Well, let's talk about some of these foundations. Now, our foundation for what we believe is under attack, starting in the book of Genesis. But let's take a look at the foundations for what evolution has. Let's start with the origin of the universe. What do we know about that? Well, here's what we got. In order to have a big bang, you have to have something go bang, don't you? If you don't have anything out there, you don't have anything to go bang, do you? Okay, that's pretty easy, isn't it? So, where did this original matter come from? That's a pretty legitimate question, isn't it? Where did the original matter come from? To dismiss or ignore this question means you have a complete story with no foundation. And remember, since evolution is based on materialism, they do not allow for supernatural events. They do not even allow for faith. Everything has to have a naturalistic cause and a materialistic value there. So where did the original matter come from to make all this universe? Where did that original matter come from for the Big Bang? If you're ignoring that, folks, you're basically saying you don't have a foundation. So the Big Bang, here's our Big Bang. 13 to 15 billion years ago, a Big Bang or explosion occurred, creating the universe. The universe began as an infinitely dense, hot fireball scrambling of space and time. Now, it's not like a dynamite explosion. Don't get that idea. That's not the Big Bang. The Big Bang is a hot fireball expansion of space and time. Everything is moving out. So that's the Big Bang. Now, remember, you can't have anything go bang until you have something there that can go bang. Where did the matter come from that created this fireball? That is a very legitimate question. Well, here's their answer. Dr. Paul Davies, he's a physicist and an evolutionist, and he tells you all about this Big Bang in his book, The Edge of Infinity. The Big Bang represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws, the sudden abrupt flash of lawlessness that allowed something to come out of nothing. It represents a true miracle? Oh, wait a minute. The whole definition of evolution says we do not allow for supernatural events. We do not allow for miracles. Right here we have a contradiction in the whole model of evolution. They have to solve this to be a credible idea. Notice I did not call it a fact or a theory. It is an idea, it is a model, or it is an hypothesis. But it is definitely not a theory. Never refer to evolution as a theory, because it does not qualify in the scientific model. Well, let's look along this. Joseph Silk, a PhD astronomer, worked at the University of Oxford. Now, this man is an evolutionist. This is what he has to say. It is only fair to say that we still have a theory without a beginning. But wait a minute. Folks, we have a beginning. We have the answers, don't we? We know who created it, what was created, how it was created, when it was created, and how long it took. We have the answers. What does the evolution model have? They don't have a beginning. Let's see where this is going to lead. Here's Sten Odenwald, PhD astrophysicist, chief scientist at Raytheon, also at NASA, says this: I was happy to announce that astronomers have not the slightest evidence for the supposed quantum production of the universe out of a primordial nothingness. They don't have a clue where this came from. In other words, this is what we're looking at from the evolution model. All these books that talk about evolution, folks, are founded on nothing. There is no foundation for what they're speaking about. No naturalistic origin. So here's what we do. If the evolution is unable to explain the origin of matter and energy through a naturalistic means, then it is without a foundation. Now I'm going to show you a technique called strategic evangelism. Because folks, the whole idea here is not to rely on our own intellectual science. The idea here is to get the real issue, which is right here, folks. And this is how you do this. If evolutionists cannot explain where the original matter came from, they do not have a foundation. Therefore, why should I accept evolution when you cannot produce the evidence? I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I will tell you about my faith. Wasn't that pretty easy? See, aren't they asking us to accept evolution by faith? If they can't produce the evidence, it has to be faith then. Folks, I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'll tell you about my faith. Oh, by the way, let me tell you about what my faith has to offer. What does your faith have to offer? Wasn't that pretty easy? We didn't have to be rocket scientists to do that. You don't have to have more than ninth grade education on science to know how to use this information to get to the real issue, which is right here. Therefore, notice that word therefore? When you read that word therefore in the Bible, what does it mean? It means go back and find out what happened. Therefore, we have a logical deduction. It is rational and reasonable to believe that God, not unknown events, created matter and energy. Folks, we have a rational and reasonable faith in Jesus Christ. We have a rational, reasonable faith in believing in the Bible and creation because we have a foundation. We know who created, what was created, how it was created, when it was created, and how long it took. You ask the evolutionists where their stuff came from. They don't have an answer, do they? You know what they do most of the time? Try and ignore it or use diversionary tactics. I need to know where that matter came from. You can't tell me that. You're asking me to accept the whole thing by faith. Well, if you want more on that, we have a whole DVD out there. There's our little advertising there. We have a whole DVD on just astronomy. Just on astronomy. Why stars do not form by natural processes, as we're normally told. The scientific evidence that has defeated the Big Bang, that you won't read in textbooks. And scientific evidence that supports a young universe. So, we've taken care of the origin of matter, the origin of the universe. Evolution does not have an answer. We do. So let's go to the origin of life now. How did life start? Well, you know there's only two possible ways. There's only two possible ways. You know, somebody comes up and say, oh, there's more ways than that. You ask them to name it. I've never had anybody in over 25 years, I've never had anybody name a credible third way life could have originated because there's only two ways. Either we evolved by natural processes or we were created. To say we came from outer space is not a third way, folks. The question is, how did life originate? There's only two possible ways here. So let's take a look at these. The issue. The model of evolution claims this. About 4.5 billion years ago, this Earth evolved into existence by natural processes. God had nothing to do with it. Then over long periods of time, chemicals began to form in this pool we nicknamed the primordial soup. Then over more long periods of time, those chemicals began to bond together to make something called molecules. And finally, over more long periods of time, these molecules bonded together to make the first living cell. We have our formula, time plus chance equals life. That's all that's needed. There's your worth right there. But you know, the Bible teaches something very different than that. The Bible is very different. You know, one of the best verses in the Bible about creation is not from the Old Testament. It's actually from the New Testament. Actually from the New Testament. Colossians 1:16 reads this. For by him were all things created, that are in heaven, that are in earth, visible and invisible. Whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things are created by him and for him. Again, notice the use of the word all there. When you go to the Greek, the word is still all. And it says visible, invisible. That includes everything. We have two opposite models here. One model says we don't need God. The other model says God did it all. That means they both cannot be right. So we need to look at this. Origin of life. What do you know about the origin of life? Well, a lot of our textbooks today say, oh, things were different. Why? Because one of the things we know is life cannot start in the presence of oxygen. Now, we need oxygen to survive, but oxygen is a detriment to the origin of life. See, oxygen is like a corrosive out here. It just pulls apart molecular bonds. Just pulls them apart. So the correct molecules could never come together to form even a protein, let alone the rest of the parts of the cell. So oxygen is a killer to the origin of life. So when our textbooks go out and say, oh, the Earth was different back then. We didn't have any oxygen in the atmosphere. And I think that's wonderful. Because let's play along with this for just a moment. You know, if we were to take all the oxygen out of the atmosphere, you know what we also take away? The ozone. And water, too. We take away the ozone. And we take away that ozone. You know what happens to all of us? We become instant crispy critters. Because the ultraviolet rays of that sun will just come down and fry all life. So life cannot start with oxygen, and it cannot start without oxygen. So our textbooks have a problem there, too. Incidentally, all the geologic research we've done show that this Earth has always had oxygen. So right there, we see our textbooks are ignoring the scientific evidence to support their model. But you know what they're teaching now? And I saw it on PBS a couple years ago. And we see it a lot in this Mars stuff we're doing today. Life didn't start on the land, folks. We crawled up out of the oceans, all the way down to the bottom of the oceans where it started. And we've gradually evolved and crawled up out of the oceans. That's how we're taught in the schools now. And I love that too, because as soon as they say we started in oceans, I say let's go to get a basic chemistry book, a beginning chemistry book, open up to a page that talks about something called hydrolysis. Because see, hydrolysis is the action of water decomposing molecules. Water is detrimental to the origin of life. See, water contains what atom? Oxygen. And that oxygen atom will insert itself right in the middle of those molecular bonds and just pull them apart. So as soon as any of these atoms got together to make these molecules, within a matter of weeks, they would have all been destroyed. So life cannot start in water. Now, what do you think about all this water on Mars bit? Even though we haven't found it. But if there's water up there, folks, life cannot start in the water. Water is necessary for life, but it is detrimental to the origin of life. Well, let's go a step further. I want to do a little terminology review. We need to do a little review here, because a lot of times we have people coming to these lectures who have been out of biology classroom for maybe a year or two. So we need just a little review here. Get some terminology. First thing we need to know is an atom. We're all pretty familiar. We've heard of an atom, basic unit of matter. That's our basic unit of matter. Now, what do atoms do? Well, they sometimes bond together to make molecules, like water, H2O. So atoms can make molecules, and sometimes molecules will bond together to make something called amino acids. Not mean old acids, but amino acids. Some of us do have mean old acids in us, but that's another topic there. Amino acids. Now, those are important because they are the building blocks of life. If you can't get amino acids, you can't get life. So they're very important here. And then finally, these amino acids sometimes will bond together to make proteins. And that's what we need here. So atoms can make molecules. Molecules can make amino acids. Amino acids can make proteins. See how easy biology really is now? A little more to it than that. But now, the reason I did that, because what I want to talk about is these amino acids, building blocks of life. There's over 2,000 different types of amino acids out there. But only 20 are ever used in life. That means life is very selective. You get one of these wrong amino acids and you could be in big trouble. That is, amino acids come in two shapes. Just like we have a left hand, we have a right hand. Notice my left and right hand are about the same, aren't they? Same components, four fingers and a thumb. But also, notice my left and right hand are really not quite the same. Because notice what happens when I put one hand behind the other. Notice my thumb and fingers are on the opposite side. So even though they have the same components, they're not quite the same. See, your hands are what you really call mirror images of each other. Mirror images. Now, these amino acids come in the same shape. We call them left-handed amino acids and right-handed amino acids. Well, what's the difference? Well, just like our hands, left and right-handed amino acids are made up of the same atoms, the same components. And also like our hands, left and right-handed amino acids are mirror images of each other. Now, why is this so important? That becomes important because every single amino acid in every protein in your body, and you have trillions of these, is left-handed. You do not have a right-handed amino acid in any protein in your body anywhere. Matter of fact, every amino acid in every protein in all life is left-handed. There are no right-handed amino acids used in proteins anywhere in life. Now, why is this so important? That becomes important, folks, because every experiment we have ever done, including this famous Miller experiment that's still used in our textbooks, every experiment that has ever been done has always ended up by naturalistic processes with an even mixture of 50% left-handed and 50% right-handed amino acids. Folks, that's not life. That is a poison to life. Every experiment ever known has failed. Even when we start with all left-handed amino acids, we can do that. We can plug them out, put them all over here. When we start with all left-handed amino acids, they will naturally start reverting back to a mixture of left and right-handedness. In other words, the natural tendency is always away from life, never towards life. So what have all these experiments created then? They've all simulated death, a poison to life. Every experiment ever done by naturalistic process always ends up with poison, death. So how did life get started then? The only way we know, folks, is it had to be created. Well, let's take a look a step further. Counterargument. Well, we got to look at these counterarguments. How about this one? Given enough time, it will happen. See, that's the evolution argument. Just throw time at it. Time has magical properties for the evolutionist. Two questions about that statement. Is that a valid statement? Is it even a scientific statement? Turns out, no to either one. It is not a valid statement. In this case, it is not even a scientific statement. Let me show you why. There's a law of large numbers, law of probability, 10 to the minus 50th power. Now, I'm going to just take the minus sign off because a lot of people don't like to work in fractions. So we'll just work in whole numbers. 10 to the 50th power, that's a big number. One followed by 50 zeros. That is a huge number. One followed by 50 zeros. What we basically say here, the law of probability is, if the chances of an event to occur are greater than this number, that event will never happen. Notice I didn't say could happen or might happen. The word is never happen. Now, I'm not the only one saying this. There's many other people that would agree with this. And let's take a look at some of these probabilities. Anything beyond 10 to the 50th power will never happen. What is the probability of a protein occurring by natural processes? Now, when we talk about a protein, that means we have to have the right amino acids in the right form, the right shape, and all left-handed. What's that probability? And incidentally, an average-sized protein has 300 amino acids in it. That's an average size. That probability for a protein to happen by natural processes, 10 to 191st power. That is so far beyond 10 to the 50th power, folks. You could take every atom in this universe, allow it to do 1 trillion atomic interactions a second for 30 billion years, and you still wouldn't get a protein. That's how big that number is. But you know it gets better than this? It gets better. What is the probability of a cell? 10 to the 40,000th power. To think that this could happen by random chance processes, ignoring the probabilities, is to ignore all known science and go off on a faith tangent. And that's what it would be, a faith tangent. Because no experiment has ever even come close. And we're still working at a protein. We haven't even talked about DNA, RNA, ATP, and the cell wall, and all those other things. We're just trying to get a protein. Probability in life. Bernard Lovell, PhD in astronomy, says it is effectively zero. It will never happen. That's what he says about probabilities. Francis Crick, strong evolutionist, anti-Bible, says it can never have happened in synthesized at all at any time. He's one of the co-discoverers of DNA. He's pretty smart. He says it can never happen. Robert Gaines, PhD, research in the field of cryophysics and information systems, says it is effectively zero that the probability of life ever occurring. It just won't happen, folks. So I'm not the only one saying about these probabilities. It will never, ever happen by natural processes. So the origin of life. Here's another gentleman, John Joe McFadden, evolutionist and professor of molecular biology and quantum physics. Now this man, I've read through his book, he is a strong evolutionist. Strong evolutionist, but look what he has to say about this. The simplest living cell could not have arisen by chance. Why don't we put statements like that in our textbooks? There's a man who knows a whole lot more than a lot of our textbook writers. Why don't they believe him? And he's an evolutionist. You see, our textbooks are censoring out the science to protect the religion of evolution. Here's another gentleman. Frank Lindemann, Harold, professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at Colorado State University, in his book, The Way of the Cell. Now, this man is a strong evolutionist, too. I want to make sure you understand, this man believes in evolution. But look what he has to say also. The origin of life is also a stubborn problem with no solution in sight. Why don't we be fair in our education and put all the information in there? Origin of life. If evolution is unable to explain the origin of life through naturalistic means, then it is without a foundation. What do we say next? Why should I accept evolution? You cannot produce the evidence. I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'll tell you about my faith. See, there's a simple way. Tell me how life originated. And if you can't do that, you're asking me to accept evolution by faith. I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'll tell you about my faith. Oh, by the way, tell me what your faith has to offer me, and I'll tell you what my faith has to offer you. See how quick we can take it from the science to the real issue? It's a stubbornness right here, folks. It's a willful stubbornness by many not to accept the gospel of Jesus Christ. Therefore, there's our therefore, logical deduction. It is rational and reasonable to believe that God, not unknown events, create life. See, we're being asked to accept unknown events. Well, folks, I already know my events. I know who created. I know what was created. I know how it was created. I know when it was created. And I know how long it took to create. I have a foundation. So far, evolution does not. They're asking us to accept another faith. And if you want more on that, there's our advertisement. Now, I want to make sure you understand. This is a 3-hour video teaching, student manual, teacher's guide. You know what we're doing? We're going to give that away for $19 tonight. $19. That's what we're going to do for that, because we want this information out. This course has been used by many students in secular schools to change teachers' lives, learning how to do that. So now we've taken to our two areas, the origin of the universe, the origin of life. Let's talk about the fossil record. Let's do that one. You know, the fossil record's not a hard one to do. Not hard at all. There's our fossil record. Oh, throughout all this geologic column, all the way up and down. But you know, there's only one place we have to go. See, one of the things we need to learn how to do is how to do a discussion. How to control the discussion. Need to know how to control the discussion here. All we need to do is go all the way down to the bottom. It's the only place you need to go in the fossil record. Precambrian, Cambrian. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, those are the early stages in the geologic column. Precambrian is where we have find these single-cell organisms, and we find single-cell organisms. When we get up to Cambrian, that's where we find these tremendously complex organisms, like seashells, trilobites, jellyfish. Very complex. Now, if evolution is true, going from a single cell to a creature that has billions and billions of cells in it, we should find a lot of things in between, shouldn't we? We should find millions of things in between a single cell and a jellyfish, or a single cell and a clam. We should find lots of things. So here's our picture. On the vertical, I have time. Horizontal, I have morphology. Oh, morphology is one of those words. Anybody here have morphology? Raise your hand if you have morphology. Ooh. We've got a problem here. If you don't have morphology, then you are a blob. Morphology means shape. Now, I know some of you really don't have morphology until you've had their first cup of coffee. That's a no. Morphology, shape. Then down the center, I have the line separating the Precambrian and the Cambrian. Now, evolution. Darwinian model says we start with this single cell, then we should have this tree of life branching off, getting more and more complex. So single cell, two cell, 10 cell, 100 cell, 1,000 cells, million cell creatures. We should find them all through this leading up to the Cambrian time period. But in fact, what we actually see is this. That is the actual observed data. The sudden appearance in the fossil record of very complex organisms with no intermediates. How do you go from a single cell to a trilobite creature that has very complex eye system with no intermediates? That's not evolution. That's created after their kind. Now, I'm the only one saying this. No, here's Ariel Roth, PhD in zoology, says this. The Cambrian explosion is not just a case of all the major animal phyla appearing at about the same place in the geologic column. It's also a situation of no ancestors to suggest how they might have evolved. There's absolutely no ancestors to these creatures. A complete void in the fossil record. Here's another gentleman, Ernst Mayr. Now, this man, I like this one. I've read his book called What Evolution Is. He is a very strong evolutionist. He's considered to be the Darwin of the 20th century. Very strong evolutionist. And look what his words are about the fossil record. Given the fact of evolution, notice he calls evolution a fact, one would expect the fossils to document a gradual, steady change from ancestral forms to the descendants. But this is not what the paleontologist finds. Instead, he or she finds gaps in just about every phyletic series. Notice he calls it a fact, but yet he can't support it with the evidence. I thought science required observable evidence, but evolution apparently does not. You see the problem here? Even the evolutionists admit the fossil record does not support evolution. But you know what our textbooks teach? There's many intermediates out there, but you know, when I read these textbooks, I don't find any. I find a few pictures they've drawn, but I can't find all the intermediates in the textbooks. So the fossil record, based on the evolution model, the entire foundation for Darwinian evolution, the fossil record is missing. So where do we go now? Why should I accept evolution when you cannot produce the evidence? I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'll tell you about my faith. You see, they're asking us again to accept evolution by faith. We need to stick to these foundational issues, force them to produce the evidence. If they cannot do it, go right to here. You're asking me to accept evolution by faith. I already have a faith. Why is your faith any better than my faith? What does your faith have to offer me? And I'll tell you what my faith has to offer. We're right to the gospel now, aren't we? That's the power, folks. It's the word of God that is the power, not my science knowledge. Therefore, it is rational and reasonable to believe that God, not unknown events, created all life after its kind. See, we do have a very rational and reasonable faith. It is based on the evidence, the observable evidence, not pictures. Well, let's do the last one, dinosaurs. Everybody likes dinosaurs, but we're not going to go into all these shapes and sizes of dinosaurs. I'm going to show you what to do about dinosaurs. First of all, we need to know how to ask the right question. That's the first key. Most people in churches are asking the wrong questions here. See, the lesser question is, what happened to the dinosaurs? Well, as far as we know, they're all dead. Notice how I said that? As far as we know, they're all dead. They're probably on Mars somewhere. Now, what happened to the dinosaurs? Well, that's the lesser question. See, the important question is this. Where did the dinosaurs come from? That's the question you need to be asking the evolutionists. Where did they come from? Well, let's take a look at why that's an important question. The standard story about dinosaurs is this. About 220 million years ago, the first dinosaurs evolved from mammal-like reptiles or amphibians. Long before man evolved, these creatures ruled the earth for millions of years, then became extinct. Now, I've gone through a lot of textbooks, and there's something missing in every textbook. We're going to see that. Now, here's the Illustrated Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs. Dr. David Norman, 1985, makes this statement. The question of the origin of dinosaurs is one that has puzzled paleontologists for many years. What? That statement there just said they evolved into existence 220 million years ago. But you notice the textbooks don't tell you how that happened or where the intermediates are? That's why this becomes a very important question. We're going to find out there's no foundation. The Natural History Museum Book of Dinosaurs, 1998, says this. Where did dinosaurs come from? That apparently simple question has been the subject of intense debate amongst scientists for over 150 years. You're starting to see there's no foundation there. Just 220 million years ago is a claim. But claims require real evidence, don't they? The origin of dinosaurs. I went through almost every major biology textbook, went through many other other journals. And of all these textbooks, only very few of them could name one possible intermediate called the thecondit. And here's what they have to say about it. Small lizards that ran on two legs and gave rise to giant reptiles collectively known as dinosaurs. That one creature there gave rise to the Triceratops, Tyrannosaurus rexes, and all these great big long-necked sauropods. Now, let's get to some critical thinking about this. How could a small reptile evolve into all these large dinosaurs? What's the mechanism for that to happen? Mutations and natural selection do not work. That doesn't happen. That does not support evolution. Shouldn't there be thousands, if not millions of intermediates from that small little reptile that walked on two legs into something like a Triceratops, has all these big bony frills and horns sticking out? Shouldn't there be millions of intermediates? We don't find any, folks. Not a one. You know that Triceratops just suddenly appears in the fossil record? And how about this? Why don't we see these intermediates in museums? I go to these museums, you know what I see? Dinosaurs. I don't see these thousands and millions of creatures that led up to the dinosaurs. I see dinosaurs. When I open up all these books, I see pictures of dinosaurs, but nothing leading up to the dinosaurs. It's as if they were created after their kind. Great claims, folks, require real evidence. To make that claim 220 million years ago, the dinosaurs evolved into existence requires real evidence. Our students are being, here's your technical term, snookered. We need to back up what we're saying with real evidence, and it's not being done. Origin of dinosaurs. Here's the biblical model. And God made the beast of the earth after its kind, the cattle after its kind, everything that creep upon the earth after its kind. God saw it's good. You know, he did that on day six. Notice that beast of the earth. Those are the land animals, cattle, land animals. On day six, God made the land animals. And who were the land animals? That included the dinosaurs, doesn't it? The Bible clearly teaches dinosaurs and people lived at the same time. To deny that is to deny that statement right there. No other day does God say he made land creatures. Well, let's go on. Origin of dinosaurs. Evolution is unable to provide the thousands of transitions for the origin of dinosaurs, and guess what? They're without a foundation. Now where do you go? You're getting the pattern now. Why should I accept evolution when you cannot present the evidence? I already have a faith. Tell me about your faith, and I'm going to tell you about my faith. See, this is not a hard subject once you learn. You don't have to take a biology course. You don't have to take a physics course. You just have to understand the foundation. We have answers. They don't. Therefore, it is rational and reasonable to believe that God, not unknown events, created the dinosaurs. We have answers. So what we've seen is evolution has failed on every one of those. They have no foundation. And we can go to many other areas too. So what is evolution then? Evolution is without a naturalistic explanation. No foundation for the origin of matter. No foundation for the origin of life. No foundation for the fossil record. And no foundation for the origin of dinosaurs. So what is evolution then? Evolution is a religious belief system. It must ultimately be accepted by faith. If you don't have a foundation, you have to accept it by faith. And that's what our students are going through in the public schools today. They are being forced to accept the faith of evolution. And I'm not the only one who believes this. Here's just a small list of scientists that believe this. We've got astronomers, physicists, mathematicians, nuclear chemist, geophysicist, and there's many others. And I can go on. There are thousands of scientists today that believe in a literal six-day creation, just as the Bible teaches. Why do they believe that? One, the Bible teaches that, and secondly, they can support it scientifically today. So I'll finish up here. The Bible has answers, folks. We know who created, we know what was created, we know how it was created, we know when it was created, and we know how long it took to create. We do have the answers. So why would you want to change your faith to another faith that does not have the answers?